It's Wednesday, November 13th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your daily look at news from around the state. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. In a moment, we'll dig into what the results of the recent election mean for our roads.
But first, the Colorado Supreme Court heard oral arguments today in a case challenging the state's ban on high-capacity magazines. The ban, which was put in place after the 2012 Aurora Theater shooting, prohibits magazines that hold more than 15 rounds of ammunition. The lawsuit was brought by the pro-gun group Rocky Mountain Gun Owners. It focuses on whether the ban violates the right to bear arms as stated in Colorado's Constitution.
On behalf of Rocky Mountain Gun Owners, Barry Kevin Arrington from Arrington Law Firm argued that a magazine that holds more than 15 rounds should not be described as high capacity.
What I would say is that standard capacity magazines, which are the magazines that overwhelmingly come with the weapons that they're entitled to be used as a part of, come in 20-round magazines, 17-round magazines for certain handguns. The standard capacity for most semi-automatic weapons, rifles, is 30 rounds. And those types of magazines are overwhelmingly used by law enforcement and citizens for self-defense.
And on behalf of Governor Jared Polis, Eric Olson from the Office of the Attorney General argued that high-capacity magazines are not necessary for self-defense.
There's not a single instance of anyone in Colorado actually firing more than 15 rounds to defend themselves. While on the other side of the ledger, we know there are at least two horrific tragedies that occurred in this state using large capacity magazines, and that is the peril that the legislature is trying to avoid with this law.
It's not clear when the Supreme Court will issue an opinion, but this case did get us wondering, how effective is Colorado's ban?
An undercover investigation by KUSA-TV released this week found high-capacity magazines are still being sold in gun stores in our state. Some owners are selling them disassembled, but at least two shops were found to be selling the magazines put together.
And earlier this year, KUNC's Lee Patterson looked at how the ban is enforced. She found that 6 years after it was put in place, very few people have been sentenced for violating it. And a warning for our listeners, this piece contains the sound of gunshots.
A magazine is a container that feeds ammunition into a gun. Several states have laws restricting magazine size, including Colorado, where magazines that hold more than 15 rounds of ammunition are illegal. But they're still out there.
We're looking at a couple P-Mags here that were pre-banned. We're also looking at a military-grade 30-round magazine.
This soldier didn't want me to use his name. I met him at Baker Draw, a public shooting area in the grasslands of northern Colorado.
So you have six magazines there, and they all hold more than 15 rounds.
This is correct. I don't agree with the ban, personally.
He says his magazines are legal, acquired before the ban took effect. He's practicing with them today because they're what he uses in the Army. And generally, he says, large-capacity magazines are pretty common among gun owners he knows for dealing with predators like coyotes.
Whether it be for recreation or that sense of they're carrying exactly something a service member or a policeman would carry.
Because people think it's cool.
It's cool.
Generally, people who are using large-capacity magazines at a shooting range, for example, aren't the ones getting in trouble for having them. State records show that since 2013, only 104 people have been charged with violating the ban. George Brockler is the district attorney for Colorado's 18th Judicial District, an area southeast of Denver. His office has prosecuted about a dozen of these cases.
That's a handful of cases in the tens of thousands of cases that we prosecute over the years.
One of the reasons why the numbers are so low...
We don't have roving patrols of police officers that are going door-to-door saying, hey, do you have an extended magazine? The way law enforcement comes across these things is they have reason to contact someone for a different crime.
The most common are drug and weapons offenses, like possession of a firearm by a previous offender.
And in the process of taking that firearm, they come across a magazine that violates the law, and they charge them with that, too.
Over the 6 years the ban has been in place, just 11 people, all men, have been sentenced for violating it. Brockler doesn't think the ban has had an impact on crime, and in his role as the district attorney who prosecuted the Aurora Theater shooter, Brockler doesn't think the magazine ban would have made a difference during that incident.
I just don't think you can argue that, man, if we just reduce down the magazine capacity enough, we're going to save lives. I think that is speculative.
In the case of the Aurora shooting, we'll never know if a smaller magazine would have made a difference. The incident ended when the shooter's weapon jammed. And broadly, it's difficult to legislate away mass shootings because they're so rare compared to other types of gun violence. A recent study by the RAND Corporation found no research to suggest that magazine bans reduce outcomes like firearm suicides or officer-involved shootings. Research on mass shootings and violent crime was inconclusive. State Senator Rhonda Field sponsored the magazine ban in 2013.
Tell me what it was like when you heard about the Aurora Theater shooting.
You know, I felt like my world was crumbling.
It happened in her district, and Field's own son had been shot and killed years before.
And so when this happened in my community, it was like reliving the pain that's associated with gun violence all over again.
She says she is surprised by the data that so few people have been prosecuted for violating the ban. But she brings up the large capacity magazines used in Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, and in the shooting of former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, and wonders how many potential mass shootings Colorado's law may have prevented.
The number of people that have been charged in the last or convicted, it's not great. But when you think about the future, I think it's the right thing to be doing is to limit that capacity.
But the future of these bans is in question. Gun rights groups are challenging California's. In Colorado, a lawsuit against the ban has reached the state's Supreme Court. For Guns and America, I'm Lee Patterson.
Guns in America is a public media reporting project on the role of guns in American life. You can find more stories at KUNC.org.
This case in Colorado Supreme Court is not the first time we've seen bans on high-capacity magazines challenged across the country. In today's arguments, Eric Olson from the Office of the Attorney General pointed out that every judge has upheld them.
Every judge that's looked at this and has said, this is okay. And secondly, every court that's looked at a large-capacity magazine ban under intermediate scrutiny, and all of those have been 10 round limit, so more restrictive than what we have here, have said they're okay.
Here to tell us more about how other states have dealt with these cases is Jake Charles. He's the executive director for the Center for Firearms Law at Duke Law School. Hey, Jake.
Hi, thanks for having me.
To start off with, how many other states and municipalities, too, besides Colorado, have large capacity magazine bans?
Currently, 9 other states and the District of Columbia have in effect, and they span the range. Most ban magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. Colorado's obviously is more than 15 rounds, and some other states are similar to that. All of these states also have, in effect, bans on assault weapons or so-called assault weapons, except for Colorado and Vermont. Those are the only 2 states, just the high-capacity magazine ban.
There have been challenges to those laws in other states. What have those challenges looked like? I mean, what arguments are being made in those cases?
I'm most familiar with the ones that are challenging these laws under the federal Second Amendment. And basically, the challenges are that these magazines, a lot of them come standard with many kinds of firearms, that more than 10 rounds is not an abnormally large amount. And because they're in common use, the plaintiffs say in these cases, they're protected under the Second Amendment, as the Supreme Court has seemed to suggest in the Heller case. The challenges are that these are in common use and that they're therefore protected from regulation by the Second Amendment.
And for those who aren't familiar, that Heller case is the 2008 Supreme Court case that established that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual's right to own firearms and use them in self-defense. Now, we heard the Colorado Attorney General's office today say that bans on high-capacity magazines have generally been upheld. Is that fair to say? I mean, what has been the outcome of those challenges in other states?
In every state that every federal circuit court, the federal appellate court that has decided one of these, has upheld them. All of the courts have said that if these laws do impact the Second Amendment, then the state has shown that it has a sufficient interest and these laws are sufficiently tailored to meet that interest to uphold them under the Second Amendment. And this usually happens in the way that the courts analyze these claims, the same way they analyze claims for other Second Amendment challenges, is that they'll first ask the question of whether or not what the state is doing something that burdens a Second Amendment right. And so courts will say, does having more than 10 magazines or 10 rounds in a magazine, is that something that is guaranteed by the Constitution, or are you just guaranteed the right to have ammunition, period, and it doesn't extend to, say, more than 10 rounds at one time? And so they'll say, if under step one, that's fine, under step two, the state has met its burden to show that these laws are necessary to the state interest.
Interesting. So some recent reporting here has found that some shops in Colorado are still selling high-capacity magazines, in some cases a little skirting by selling them disassembled. And in addition to that, only a few people have actually been sentenced for violating this law, this ban on high-capacity magazines. So knowing that this law may not be enforced too vigorously in Colorado, how important is this challenge to the law? I mean, why still sue?
A couple of reasons, and probably the main one, is that there's just a desire to establish what the boundaries of the Second Amendment, or here the state analog of the right to keep and bear arms, protects. And there's, you know, there's a fear in the gun rights community that this is one step that is going to lead to another step. And if they don't step in now and act to stop this legislation, or to have the courts establish that this legislation goes too far, then it's going to be too late when the next one comes along.
So you've been following challenges to various gun laws across the country. What upcoming cases will you be watching?
There are a whole host of cases that I'm watching, including the one at the Supreme Court that they're going to hear on December 2nd, a challenge to New York City regulation. So that's going to be an interesting case that, you know, if the Supreme Court reaches the merits, it might change the way that courts have been analyzing Second Amendment cases. There are also some challenges to state assault weapon bans and other high-capacity magazine bans that are currently pending before the Supreme Court, and it's deciding whether or not it's going to take up those cases. I'm watching those. I'm also watching some challenges to states' licensing regimes for what it takes to get a permit to carry a firearm outside the home. And then finally, some challenges to bans on certain classes of people owning firearms, like felons, say.
Are there any themes or trends in these lawsuits or in their outcomes that we should keep an eye on?
One big thing in this area of law right now is what framework courts should apply when looking at these challenges. And so there's kind of two competing frameworks. The one that the majority of courts adopt is this standard two-part framework that I was discussing earlier. It's how we analyze other constitutional rights. We say, is the conduct protected? And then if so, has the government met its burden to infringe that conduct? That's what the standard framework has been. The other one that a lot of gun rights advocates are pushing is called the text, history, and tradition approach. And under that approach, courts would just look to see, are these regulations longstanding? Do they have a historical pedigree in American history? And if not, then they're going to be invalid in many cases. The methodological argument is one that I'm watching a lot.
Jake Charles is the executive director of the Center for Firearms Law at Duke Law School. Jake, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In last week's election, measures to help pay for transportation failed around the state. They included Proposition CC and infrastructure taxes in both Loveland and Larimer County. So, what do these failures mean for the future of transportation in our region? Here to help us understand is Dan Micah, a reporter for BizWest. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Henry.
What does it mean for the state of our roads and transportation in general that all of these measures failed?
BizWest had a CEO roundtable a few months ago talking with local transportation officials and business leaders about this, and people are worried about this from an economic standpoint. The American Society of Civil Engineers estimates that about 22% of the entire state's roads are in poor condition or worse, and I think the message that I was hearing from there is that if local officials aren't getting funding from the state legislature in a larger fashion, so more money and getting it more regularly, eventually they're just going to have to start funding it out of their own general budgets, which is tough for any smaller government entity to do, because now you're putting up increasing road safety and road capacity against things like making sure that like hiring enough police or hiring enough firefighters or taking care of social services, or just making sure that the government is running on time and efficiently. So it's quickly, to them, becoming an issue where the state has to step in and start putting more dollars towards transportation, or it's just going to slow down the ability of local governments to govern.
What about local voters, voters who maybe drive on that stretch of 34 between Greeley and Loveland? What does it mean that they didn't want to pay taxes? Is this a sign that there's something larger happening with our constituents?
Well, that's if I were to take my take off my business reporter hat and put on my political pundit hat a little bit. The interesting thing here is that both in Larimer County and in Weld County, tax initiatives to support education both passed with, you know, a fairly decent amount of support. My guess, and what I've seen anecdotally from people, is that these road improvements were tied in with other municipal upgrades. For example, the Larimer County tax had an expansion to the courthouse attached to it, and it had an expansion to the social services center to it as well. That may have caused some folks to think, like, I would support doing the roads, or I would support expanding the courthouse, but not both of them at the same time. So it's possible that may have caused people to be less inclined towards voting for that tax increase. And also, it was an odd year election, and that tends to bring down voter turnout a bit. So, you know, a lot of factors at play.
Dan, you and I and any other person on the Front Range who uses our roads know that they're pretty congested as we've seen growth. But clearly that wasn't enough of a deal breaker for a lot of voters. Or as you said, there might have been other factors at play. But I'm wondering if you could make the case, why should we care about transportation?
I know that transportation isn't the top of mind, the hottest thing to talk about when we're talking about planning for the future. But there's two things that I would point out. Is first of all, the state demographer thinks that by 2050, Larimer County will hit 500,000 people just in terms of people moving here. And for Weld County, it's by 2050, the state demographer thinks that figure will rise to almost 700,000 people. And right now, if the roads are congested this much with how many people we have in the region right now, just imagine what that's going to be like when we have so many more people living in the region. So that's just kind of like a long-term planning thing to consider. But also just for the current economy, transportation, just as how the internet allowed the free flow of information, transportation allows for the free flow of commerce effectively throughout the region.
All right. Dan Mica is a reporter for BizWest. Dan, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, we'll hear about a program that's supporting women to go back to school and earn a living wage. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.